for helping us in the sun worship, and we'll do a bit more of that in a moment. The goal, if you like, of our three mornings, or our three sessions, we have two this morning and one tomorrow morning. As I just prayed, what I hope to do, and I was thinking about it this morning, and this is the phrase I came up with, is to try and share three non-intrusive reflections to get all of our minds pondering and thinking. Now, I use the word reflection because I want it to be something that is just a springboard. Anything I say is just a springboard for your own personal reflections, or if you've come as a couple or with kids who could be drawn into that, you know, as a family unit, reflection. And what I say is just a springboard to enable you to reflect and ponder, to learn, to implement something in your life. And I've used the word unintrusive or non-intrusive, I don't know which is the proper grammatical version of that. Not because I want to suggest in some way that reflection won't penetrate into your life, but I hope I'm not intrusive. Does that make sense? But what I do is offer enough that you can be self-intrusive, if that's a word. Does any of that kind of make sense in terms of the goal of what I'm speaking at the front is about? Is to give you something that, like a dog with a bone. You say, I can gnaw on that, and I can chew on that. And if it gives you indigestion, that's your fault, not mine. So that's what I mean by non-intrusive in that sense. But I want it to be about things which are significant and personal. So I've given these three talks, some people like titles, don't they? So the three sessions, I've given the title Making Life Work. And I've borrowed it from a very good book that's on the little book table there that you can buy by Bill Hybels. I've stolen his very good title of Making Life Work. And I want to reflect on relationships in this first session, on lifestyle in the second session this afternoon, and then on character tomorrow. And I'm very conscious that those three areas are fairly intrusive. Non-intrusive, hang on, they're fairly significant. But I think it's important. We don't have many opportunities, whatever stage of life you're in, we don't have many opportunities where we can pull into the lay-by and say, I'm just going to ponder about the journey I'm actually on. What happens is we're just driving and driving and driving and driving, and we lose sight often of, well, why am I driving in this journey? Why am I driving it with her or with him or with them? Why am I driving it with this career? We need to pause sometimes, don't we? Not just to fill up the fuel tank and get back on, but genuinely stop and think about our relationships, our lifestyle, and our character. And there's a number of things I feel need to be neutralised to help everyone feel comfortable to do that. And I want to neutralise just two straight off. And hopefully, as I go through, just by the way we do it together, I neutralise any of the other concerns you might have. I want everyone to say, I can be comfortable here, and I can do this self-reflection, and I can use Alex's words from the Bible to do that. The first thing I want to neutralise is, if you're just sitting there and saying, well, how can Alex understand me? Alex is going to dare to talk about some things as personal and significant as relationships and our character and lifestyle and our words and our actions and things. How can Alex possibly know me? Some of you looking at me and saying Alex is far too young. Some of you looking at me saying Alex is far too old. But I think it's a very legitimate concern. How can Alex possibly understand me? We have masses in common, more in common than separates us, obviously. I love that poster. I've seen a whole bunch of places. Six or seven skeletons, identical skeletons on this poster. Under each one is a category, atheist, Christian, Buddhist, whatever. But then blazed across the top is, underneath we're all the same. And each skeleton is identical. Of course, there's more we have in common. But the reality is, there's also massive distinctions, isn't there? I've only had my upbringing. I've only had my education, I've only had my marriage, I've only had my parenting, I've only had my career, and the list could go on, and that's different to you, isn't it? And so actually, it would be foolish to dare to try and steal haphazard subjective tidbits from my life and try and insert them on yours. So I'm going to neutralise that by simply saying I'm not going to do that. I have no ambition or goal to draw from my experience and try and deposit into your different experience. My goal is to draw on the Bible's well of wisdom and use what the Bible says to stimulate our reflection. So in that sense, I'm not going to be an author who creates his own material. I'm not going to be a storyteller who autobiographically recounts my experience. I hope I'll be a genuine teacher who is simply explaining someone else's work to you, the Bible's work, the Bible has what it has to say. And that might raise just the second thing I want to neutralise right at the beginning, which might make you not be able to just relax and feel comfortable, which you might now say, well, okay, Alex isn't going to try and understand me, that's good, but how can the Bible help me? Because isn't that a really ancient book? And this is a very complex world. And that might be legitimate as well, except I'd cite back to you C.S. Lewis, you know, the writer of Chronicles of Narnia? He uses this great phrase. He warns us to not be chronological snobs. And I like that phrase, a chronological snob. He says, actually, we live in a time where anything that is old, we dismiss. We say it's no good. Like those foolish people who say the original A-Team series is no good and the new film is better. No. Actually, C.S. Lewis says quite the opposite is true. The very fact something is old and has stood the test of time and has filtered through all the different cultures and has been found credible actually is a massive suggestion. It's the very place we should go to find wisdom and to find things to reflect on. Gandhi, who himself wasn't a Christian, but was hugely respectful of Jesus, he says this. He says, you Christians look after a document containing enough dynamite to blow all civilizations to pieces, turn the world upside down, and bring peace to a war-torn planet, but you treat it as if it was though it was nothing more than a piece of literature. And I think Gandhi's got it spot on there, that actually we have a tried and tested source of wisdom that we can draw on, humanly credible, because chronologically over time and culturally over all the different cultures of the world, people say this has something worth listening to. And for those of us who are Christians, we would say the root of its human credibility is its divine authorship. The reason it's credible is because God wrote it, and if God gave us the lives we want to see work, what better place to go to than the book he wrote about those lives? And so the little kids illustration that we use with the kids in children's church about the Bible being God's instruction manual, well it is, isn't it? There's no point if you drive a Honda opening up a Vauxhall instruction manual, is there? Probably not much point opening up a Honda instruction manual either, but you know, you've got to go to the right manual, you've got to go to the Bible. So I hope by neutralising just those two, about me and about the Bible, the list of others you might have saying, where your shoulders aren't quite relaxed where I want them to be, I can self-reflect. I can allow myself to be intrusive into my life. I can pull over into the lay-by and assess the journey I'm on and why I'm on it. I hope you see where my heart is to try and neutralise anything that might stop you doing that and create a space where you can. Johnny will help with music, Chris will help at different points to draw us in, but really it's down to you and me. And that's why I'll be as much listening as speaking, so I can be drawn into that process, and Hannah and I can be as well. So that's an elongated introduction, really, to the next 2 days. So I hope it's useful. If it wasn't, you can just start again, reboot, and we'll begin again at the start of tonight, this morning's rather little talk. I want to think about relationships. And they matter, that's obvious, isn't it? Think of the 5 most precious aspects of your life. Guaranteed, at least 4, if not all 5, are relationships. If you think about things that you value and are important, it'll be a list of relationships. If you list the 5 most painful aspects of your life, the 5 most painful memories you have, they'll be linked to a relationship that's probably gone wrong, or a loved one who you've lost to death or something, and there's pain there. Relationships are hugely important, aren't they? And the Bible, they're massively important in the Bible. Most of what the Bible has to say is actually about relationships. So you think of the 10 Commandments, if you're familiar with them. It's all about relationships. The 10 Commandments say nothing about us as an individual. They say everything about loving God, but mostly actually the 10 Commandments about loving each other. And if you know Jesus' great summary of the 10 Commandments, when someone says, what's the greatest one? Do you remember what he said, if you're familiar with it? He said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind and strength, relationship in the vertical, and love others as you love yourself, a horizontal relationship that's right and proper. And the reason our relationships are so important, and this is key, is because God made us to be relational people. So if you know the story of how people are created, it says God created us in his image, and God, it's that complex mystery, is Father, Son and Spirit relating to one another. He says, I want you to show what I am like in the world, and the only way we can show the love of God is how? If we have someone to love. The only way we can show the justice of God is if we've got someone to express justice towards. The only way we can show the faithfulness of God is if there's someone we can be faithful to. And so when God made the world, he didn't just make a person, did he? He made people. And he didn't just make us all clones of one another and identical. He made us massively diverse. Even identical twins are not identical, are they? So there is the myriad and plethora of relationships expressed between human beings. And in that relationship, in the connection between two people, that is where God is shown. So you won't see God if you look at Alex on his own. You'll only see God as you look at the relationships I have with the people around me. It's like there's a thousand golden threads flowing out of every one of us connecting to a thousand other people, and it's the golden thread that shows what God is like. If you've got a Bible, I'd love for you to find 1 Thessalonians, which means you'll probably need to use the index. Hey Ross, welcome to the church weekend away. 1 Thessalonians. If you're using one of these bluey green ones, it's page 1186. Do use the index if you've got a Bible. 1 Thessalonians, or if you've got it on your phone, it's easy, isn't it? Because you just cheat on your phone. 1 Thessalonians. And I just want to share some reflections from one sentence this morning, first of all, out of 1 Thessalonians. 1 Thessalonians, chapter 1, and sentence number 3. And this is what it says. It's a letter written by a man called Paul to a church in Thessalonica. And the third sentence of chapter 1, it says, "We remember before our God and Father your work produced by faith, your labour prompted by love, and your endurance inspired by hope in our Lord Jesus Christ." And there Paul has articulated the three key relationships that exist in any human life, which I'm asking us to reflect on. The first one, work produced by faith, is about our relationship with God. Faith is the key word to describe how we relate to God. The second, labour prompted by love, I'll show is our relationship with one another and how we relate to people around us. And the third, your endurance inspired by hope, is our relationship, if you like, to the future and how key that is to make our present work, is having a clarity about our future. So let's take each in turn. I'll move quite quickly, and I just want you to grab the one or two things out of this that you then want to allow to percolate in your mind after I've finished talking for a while. So I really don't mind, mentally, if in the first couple of minutes now you grab something and switch off for the rest of the talk, because mentally you want to focus on that thing. Does that make sense? Already right now you might be thinking the thing I want to grab on is about relationship with God or with one another or the future. You might already know which is the thing that you want to focus attention on. So I don't mind at all. If you close your eyes and start snoring, I'll know that you're not doing that. I know you're doing something else. But enjoy the singing last night that some of us enjoyed. Yeah. So here's the first one, a work of faith, a genuine trust in God. Are we relating to God with trust and obedience or with complacency and dismissal? So he says, how we relate to God is with faith. And faith is more than just trust. It's more than just belief. Faith is a level of trust which means it changes how you live. Ideally, it's how a child should relate to their parent. So a child should trust a parent so fully that even when the parent says, "Don't do that," and the child doesn't understand why they're not meant to do it, they don't act in that way. Because they trust the parent so much, they obey what the parent has to say, even when it doesn't make any sense to them. Does that make sense? So that's what the word faith means, a level of trust which works. You see what's called a work of faith. True level of trust will display itself in how we work. To have that kind of trust in God, we need to know who he is, isn't he? So I'm going to rest slightly longer on this first relationship to get that straight. Glance down, if you've got a Bible, to the middle of verse 9 and verse 10, because here he describes what God is like. He's talking about these folk who'd become Christians, about 6 weeks old as Christians they were when he wrote this. And he says, they tell, he's talking about lots of people all around, he says, they tell how you turn to God from idols to serve the living and true God and to wait for his Son from heaven, whom he raised from the dead, Jesus, who rescues us from the coming wrath. Let me give you some markers of who God is there. But first of all, we're told that God is a living and true God, not a dead and empty placebo. It says they turned from idols to serve the living and true God. Now, when it says idols, don't think of wooden statues and bronze imaging, which is what we do. It's what was going on there. But that's not what an idol is. That's a manifestation of an idol. An idol is simply anything which we place as God in our lives. An idol is anything which we seek the satisfaction that only God can give to us in. And so modern idols, the same with ancient idols, we might not have the little statues and the pictures. Teenage girls might have One Direction. Oh, in fact, I've discovered year one girls have One Direction on their bedroom walls. We might have imagery, but what that imagery simply does is point to the deeper root of the idol in our life. So some of us, it's our family that is our idol. We get all our meaning and our satisfaction out of our family. But as great as that is, a family is only a cheap imitation of what God offers. It's a wonderful and a good thing, but it was only ever there to give you a taste of what God fully offers. For others, it's the security of a decent-sized pension, or knowing there is reserves in the bank that if you lost your job, you'd have a good 6 months before you became financially squeezed. And there's nothing wrong with good financial management. But it's an idol when you place your security and your satisfaction in that, as opposed to in God. It's the Tesco's own brand, cheap imitation of the real deal that is available. C.S. Lewis, who is one of my favourites, he puts it like this. It says, it would seem that our Lord finds our desires not too strong, but too weak. We are half-hearted creatures fooling about with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered to us. Like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at the sea. We are far too easily pleased. So he says, God is the living and the true God. Don't be satisfied with placebos, with idols. Don't be satisfied with just enough satisfaction that you go unsatisfied when infinite joy is offered by the true and living God. So I ask, where's your faith in God? What position? And some of us could well not be Christians, wouldn't maybe describe ourselves as such, not keen Christians. But where's our faith in God? Are we playing around in the mud pies of the slum with whatever it might be? Maybe it's Lewis's drink, sex and ambition. Maybe it's my description of family or the money in the bank. But what? Your creative energy, your reputation, all these things are idols, you see. When, they're not bad in themselves, but when they stand where only God should stand, when you seek your joy and satisfaction in them, a joy and satisfaction only God can fulfill. Secondly, who this God is, he carries on, he says, and he sent his son from heaven. Did you hear, or if you've got the Bible there, it says that. A son from heaven as opposed to a man from earth. Now, son, Greek and Hebrew culture in the first century when this is written, son doesn't mean a biological descendant. It means one in the essence of, is what it means. So, for example, when an apprentice graduated and could run his own blacksmith, he was called the son of whoever his original trainer had been. Not because he was biologically related, but because he, in essence, was now the same as. So a son from heaven, one who is God from heaven, not a man from earth. And actually, if you do spend a moment, if you want to, reflecting on other religions and why Christianity has a credibility that other religions don't, here's the hub of it. Is all other religions simply claim to have a man or a woman at the centre who pointed to God, but Christianity says it's about God who came from heaven to earth. And so it's a God who is from heaven, who is here, not simply about a man from the earth. Third marker, he says, whom he raised from the dead. And then just in case we're not sure who he's talking about, he puts Jesus. So we know it's Jesus he's talking about. Again, this is a God who defeats our greatest enemy. And sadly, that assassin is crouching at all our doors at any minute, isn't it? And some of us have lived this more recently with losing loved ones. But here we have a God who's raised us, raised Jesus from the dead, and we'll see how that affects our hope in a moment. And then lastly, a God who rescues from the coming wrath. Now, wrath is not a very popular name, a word, is it? But it's God's rightful anger at what's unjust and wrong in the world. And here we have a God who's ready and willing not just come to the earth, but to rescue us from that rightful anger. And so it's not just a personal preference or a cultural construct. It really is a great rescue. So the first and probably the major thing I'm going to emphasise, I'm inviting us to reflect on in the space of the lay-by that we have this weekend, or at least in the mornings, away from the rush and the hubble and the busyness, is where are we when it comes to God? What's our faith in God, which I know many of us would say we have, but where actually is it? Is it in the living and true God, who actually is the only real satisfier? Or actually, are there idols, placebos, who challenge God's position? Are we more deeply satisfied, not in God, but in various aspects of our life, our career, our reputation, our financial stability, our creative or musical skills? Are we more satisfied in our family than we are in God? It means we've not actually seen who God is. It means we're satisfied with the mud pies, which are quite good fun, aren't they? Because we haven't seen the offer of a holiday at the beach that is there for everyone. He's the living and the true God. Second set of relationships, we're going to move more quickly. I wonder if these are the ones you want to reflect on. He describes in that phrase, back in sentence number 3, your labour prompted by love. Now, the love he's talking about here is on the horizontal, because later on in this letter, you could look at chapter 4, verse 9, he uses the same word for love and says, now about your love for one another, we do not need to write to you, for you yourselves have been taught by God how to love each other. So he's talking about how we love the people around us. He's not talking about a self-love or a love to God. He's talking about the love to people around us. The word he uses, did you notice, is your labour of love. And that's come into common coinage, isn't it, without people realising it's from the Bible. My labour of love, I labour in love. Now that's an agricultural term. It's a term describing someone who in the heat of the day, their role is to spend 8, 10, 12 hours digging holes. That is sweaty, hard, grimy, dirty, difficult, sacrificial work, isn't it? The closest I get is when Hannah asked me to nip down to our allotment and turn over a couple more rows so she could put some more seeds in. And I'm like this, I'm like, oh, come on, do I have to? Like I turn into a teenager in a split second. And it's intense physical labour. Now we have a definition culturally of love, which is all sentiment and feeling, haven't we? I feel in love. Or it's a sentiment, and I will love when it's nice and gooey and pleasant. I'm caricaturing, but we do, don't we? And when that feeling has dried up, culturally we feel we have a right, therefore, to abandon that relationship. I don't feel in love with that person anymore. I don't love that football team. I don't love that man. I don't love that woman. I don't love that child. What you mean is I don't feel very loving towards them. Probably more to do with the fact you didn't get enough sleep last night, or didn't have a decent breakfast, or there's a stress somewhere else and you haven't got a dog to kick. It's not, you know, they're not trustworthy feelings, are they? In the Bible, love is an act of will. Love is an activity. The man who has to dig a hole for 12 hours, otherwise he won't have anything to eat that evening, doesn't get out of bed and say, do I feel like digging holes today? I don't fancy it today. Because why would you ever fancy digging holes? He gets up and he says, it is my job to dig holes. And so here, Paul is saying, as is consistent with all the descriptions of love in the Bible, is it's not about what we can get out of the relationship, it's about what we can give. It's not about how we are served, but it's how we can sacrifice for others. It's that kind of language. So I'm going to throw out the question again. What kind of love do you show to people around you? In concentric circles, from the ones closest to you, married, children, grandparents, family members, concentric circles out, all that myriad of gold threads that connect us all in our relationships, how do you relate? Is it like the Bible would say, Mark 10:45, even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, but to love others by, in Jesus' case, dying on the cross. Mark 10:41, do not be like others, who lord it over them. In your relationships, don't be the lord, be the servant in love. So where are you in your faith with God? Is he the deep satisfier of your life? Where are you in your relationships with others? Is it all about, however subtly and pleasantly, all about what I can get? Or is it all about the labour of love? What can I give? How can I sacrifice? And of course, if we're all giving, we're all getting, aren't we? You know, by definition. If we're all seeking what can we get, none of us are getting. Does that, you might have to reflect on that for a moment, but it does make sense if you think about it. And then the third relationship to ponder on is this endurance of hope. He said, our work produced by faith, our labour prompted by love, so we've had the vertical, the horizontal, and now your endurance of hope, which is about a resolute confidence in the future that shapes our presence. And I know it's that because, again, later on in this letter, chapter 4, verse 13, he tells us actually it's about what happens at our death. It's that part of our future. He says, brothers and sisters, this is chapter 4, verse 13, we do not want you to be uninformed about those who sleep in death, so you do not grieve like the rest of mankind who have no hope. See the repeat of that word hope, endurance of hope. And then we do not want you to be misinformed about the fact that Jesus' promise is death will be defeated for you and there's an eternal life that comes. And that means that shapes how we live today. And that's why he uses the word endurance of hope. Did you see it? They've escalated up, haven't they? A work of faith, doesn't sound too serious, does it? A labour of love, intense physical labour. Endurance of hope? Now that's an athletic term. It was used to describe the runners in the original marathons, which were not a mere 26.2 miles. That was your warm-up stretch. These were 3 or 4 days cross wilderness where somewhere between a third and a half of participants died during the event, ripped to shreds by mountain lions or exposure out in the deserts or something like that. And so the root of the Greek word endurance is the same as the Greek word death, because they were linked together. And I think what Paul is saying is if you're going to have faith in God, you're going to have that work of faith and you're going to have that labour of love, that is what? That's going to be like a marathon. That's going to be intensely brutal. How will you get to the finish line? Only if you know what is at the finish line is worth getting to. The hope of what comes after death. Does that make sense? And so actually the certainty of our future, and maybe this is something for you to ponder about, particularly if your present right now is a real struggle. What will get you through is you know what comes at the end. You know what's across the finish line. And so you keep running now. Some of us have run marathons. I've done 3. But I say that now, the last one was about 15 years ago, quite literally, so I don't know if I can count it in the present tense. But the only reason, especially in the middle one, when I tore a hamstring at mile 18, the only reason I finished the last 8 miles, well, it was twofold. One was because Hannah was there and we weren't yet married and there was something going on and I had to go over that finish line. But two was because I wanted the medal. I wanted the medal. I remember running like this, this leg, practically useless. I even did a whole chunk of it next to the pavement so I could run with this foot on the pavement so because I couldn't straighten it properly. So I'm running like, you know, like this to get that last 8 miles. The only reason we get through the difficult bits of life, that we keep having faith in God, that we keep loving sacrificially others when we don't want to and it's hard, it's the endurance of hope. There'll come a day when God will look to us and on the other side of death, say, well done, my good and faithful servant. You got here. And so it's not pie in the sky, this idea of a defeat of death. It's radically about shaping our lives today. I think it was Aristotle, supposedly, but none of you are going to correct me, I'm sure, who said, the unexamined life is a life not worth living. I.e., if you don't pull into a lay-by when opportunity presents itself and think about your journey and your destination, then you're just burning petrol for no purpose. There's got to be moments where we pause in the busyness and say, why am I doing this? Am I doing this right? How can I do this better? Doesn't matter where your life is. Where am I with my faith with God? Have a genuine ponder about that. Where are you with your love of others? Are you a giver or a getter? We can slip into being a getter without meaning to. A bit of entitlement. I deserve this. And where are we when it comes to our ability to endure in the struggles? And are we allowing the hope of eternity to fuel our ability to survive the present? Johnny, maybe you just play something instrumentally for us for a good 3 or 4 minutes, which would be a long time, it'll feel like eternity. But sometimes it takes a while before we start to say, I'm going to think about these things. I'm going to stop thinking about did I leave the cooker on, or the loft installation, or the extension that needs building, or the grades that need to be marked. I'm going to think about the bigger questions. So let Johnny just play with us, play to us and Tom for 3 or 4 minutes, and then we'll move into a time of some more singing, maybe some prayer. I put it into Chris and Johnny's hands, really, to guide the last third of our meetings as they see fit. Or you could just walk out into the sunshine, couldn't you? Maybe take your Bible, maybe not, and just say, I know there's tea and coffee in about 15 minutes. I'm just going to take 15 minutes on my own. So do whatever you're comfortable with. But let's start by sitting and listening to a bit of music.